from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Major differences remain between Iran and the so-called P5+1 on several key issues as Tuesday's deadline for a final nuclear deal approaches. That, according to a senior Western diplomat, Friday. The open issues reportedly include sanctions relief and access to Iranian military sites, with those remaining extremely problematic, according to the diplomat. Talks in Vienna between Iran and Russia, the U.S., Britain, France, China, and Germany are in their final phase.
Our nation was founded on a bedrock principle that we are all created equal. The project of each generation is to bridge the meaning of those founding words with the realities of changing times.
That was President Barack Obama Friday after the U.S. Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision, struck down laws prohibiting same-sex marriage throughout the nation. That decision came nearly two decades after President Bill Clinton signed the so-called Defense of Marriage Act, or DOMA, which passed both houses of Congress with lopsided margins. Senator Ted Kennedy was one of only 14 senators to vote no.
Madam President, I oppose the so-called Defense of Marriage Act, and I regret the Senate is allocating scarce time at the end of this Congress to consider this unconstitutional, unnecessary, and divisive legislation. Nevertheless, I continue to be opposed to the Defense of Marriage Act for a variety of reasons. We all know what is going on here. I regard this bill as a mean-spirited form of Republican legislative gay bashing, cynically calculated to try and inflame the public 8 weeks before the November 5th election. After all, the Hawaii court case that started all this won't be final for another 2 years. According to Hawaiian authorities, and the outcome of the case is far from certain. Even if the Hawaii courts eventually approve same-sex marriage, other states have ample authority under current law to reject that decision in their own courts. In fact, states and local governments across the country are already dealing with this issue in their own ways. Some have enacted domestic partnership laws. In others, mayors and governors have issued executive orders for public employers. They don't need help from Congress to address this subject. And federal law, which has never recognized same-sex marriage, hardly needs clarification at this suspicious moment. This contrived debate has been gratuitously brought before Congress 1 month before adjournment. It has been placed on a suspiciously fast track to enact despite the press of other business. The obvious explanation is a crass desire for partisan gain at the expense of tolerance and mutual understanding.
Nevertheless, President Clinton signed the bill, which, by defining spouse and its related terms to signify a heterosexual couple in a recognized marriage, codified non-recognition of same-sex marriages for all federal purposes, including insurance benefits for government employees, Social Security survivors benefits, immigration, bankruptcy, and the filing of joint tax returns. It also excluded same-sex spouses from the scope of laws protecting families of federal officers, laws evaluating financial aid eligibility, and federal ethics laws applicable to opposite-sex spouses. The various states did enact laws, most of them outlawing same-sex marriages, with many granting separate and unequal domestic partnership status. The struggle moved to the states. In New York, which defined marriage as between a man and a woman, a young Green Party mayor, Jason West, in New Paltz, New York, decided to push the margins. In March of 2004, he began marrying same-sex couples in his capacity as an officer of the state of New York.
Then by the power vested in me by the state of New York, I now declare you legally wed.
He was arrested and charged with violating state law. This was New Paltz Chief of Police, Ray Zappone.
The state law interpretation, my interpretation of the law and the interpretation of the district attorney is that the mayor was in violation of state domestic relations law.
West insisted he violated no laws.
Do you feel you've broken the law?
Absolutely not. I abided by the Constitution of New York State and my oath of office to defend that Constitution. The Constitution is the highest law of the state, and it clearly defines that we have equal protection under the law. Our laws within the Constitution are gender neutral. Domestic relations law mentions no gender whatsoever. And I have to, I'm forced to, by my oath of office, my own conscience, to abide by this equal protection clause of our state Constitution.
The state's highest court disagreed, and it took an act of the state legislature 7 years later to bring marriage equality to the Empire State. But on Friday, the U.S. Supreme Court, in essence, vindicated the Green Party mayor of Little New Paltz, New York, Jason West. China issued a report Friday that reviews the human rights record of the U.S. for 2014. It was undertaken in response to the various U.S. reports on human rights practices of other countries.
A country where civil rights are threatened by rampant violent crimes. The report quotes FBI figures that say there were an estimated 1.2 million violent crimes reported in 2013. Among them, 14,000 were murders, 80,000 rapes, with the remaining either robberies or aggravated assaults. There was also an excessive use of violence by police. The report says that at least 400 deaths happen every year in the US as a result of law enforcement activities by police officers. The report noted that money is a deciding factor in US politics. It also says that political rights are not being properly protected, and due to political manipulation, the average American is increasingly losing confidence in electoral politics. As reported in December 2014, only 9% of Americans approved the country's Congress in the weeks leading up to the midterm elections. And not enough efforts are being made to ensure the economic and social rights of US citizens. The unemployment rate in the US and the high poverty rate left 1 in 7 Americans relying on food handouts and meal service programs. In addition, the US healthcare system appears unfit for the needs of many ordinary citizens, and the right to education for some people is also at risk. Racial and institutional discrimination against ethnic minorities has continued. Minority groups and indigenous people are subjected to unfairness in fields such as the environment, elections, healthcare, housing, and education. In addition, there are also issues of inadequate protection of women and children's rights, and violations of human rights in other countries. The report says massive overseas surveillance programs violated other countries' sovereignty and civil rights.
Statistics in the United States show that the common face of terrorism in the country is not that usually pictured in mainstream media. Press TV's Colin Campbell filed this report from Washington, D.C.
If you watch the mainstream media in the United States, minorities are often depicted as what terrorists look like. For example, Dzhokhar Tsarnaev, who was just sentenced to death for the deadly Boston Marathon bombing in 2013, has become the face of U.S. domestic terrorism. However, statistics tell a different story of who commits the most acts of terrorism within the U.S. soil. A continuing tally of terrorist attacks from the New America Foundation finds that white, right-wing Americans have actually been the biggest terror threat to the United States since the 9/11 attacks. White, right-wing extremists have murdered 48 Americans in the 14 years since 9/11, while other extremist groups have murdered 19 people since that same point of time. Although the New America Foundation stands behind its figures, its findings may be disputed. It considers the recent shooting in Charleston as a terrorist attack, one that was racially motivated, but the U.S. government hasn't given it that distinction. Acts of racist terrorism are recently being highlighted in the wake of a terrorist attack in a church in Charleston during which 9 black Americans were killed by a white man. A former self-proclaimed racial terrorist explains how people like him were radicalized.
I was told that the white race was being attacked from all sides and that minorities were to blame for all the problems that I was having. I bought in.
Last week's church shooting led to a hot debate over the American Civil War era Confederate flag, a banner that was used for racial terrorism and scare tactics against minorities in U.S. history. It flies on State House grounds in South Carolina, where some lawmakers and protesters have been calling for its removal. But the debate has also spread to other states that incorporate it into their state flag, like the state of Missouri.
I'm in favor of the flag coming down. I never thought that it meant good for our citizens of this state, and good for our state.
The study has also found that defendants who were not white received harsher sentences in the courts of justice compared to their white counterparts in the United States. Colin Campbell, Press TV, Washington.
Greece and its creditors failed once again to clinch a deal after their third meeting in a week Thursday, setting the stage for a last-minute round of negotiations over the weekend to try to avert a default next week. Fears of financial market turmoil continued with the holdover of the talks, with some Asian stocks Friday losing 10% of their value. Greece's three creditor institutions put another final cash for reform proposal on the table in an attempt to face down Greece's leftist government. Eurogroup chair Yorin Dieselbloem said there was still time for a deal.
The door is still open for the Greek side to come with new proposals or to accept what is on the table.
Greece's Prime Minister Alex Tsipras expressed confidence that a compromise could be reached.
So I think that European history is full of disagreements, negotiations, and then compromises. So after the comprehensive Greek proposals, I'm confident that we will reach a compromise that will help Eurozone and Greece to overcome the crisis.
Germany's Chancellor Angela Merkel said that her side agreed that a deal must be struck Saturday.
We waren uns einig, dass weitergearbeitet werden muss mit den drei Institutionen.
We agreed that there is the need for further work with the three institutions, the Eurogroup and Greece, and that the summit on Saturday, I mean the Eurogroup on Saturday, is of decisive importance. Bearing in mind, time is very short, and that everyone in the European Council agrees that a solution must be found on Saturday, therefore a decisive meeting.
France's president, François Hollande, intimated that the Eurogroup was waiting for more concessions from Greece.
It's crucial because for several days now, an agreement has been in sight, but it has not been finalized. So we have to do everything, and France is working on it, so that a global and lasting agreement can be reached, and so that Greece makes propositions which permit the institutions to be able to start this conclusive phase.
Stephen Hazler is professor of government at London Metropolitan University, with visiting professorships at Johns Hopkins and Georgetown Universities and the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. He is also the director of the Global Policy Institute in London. He told Crosstalk host Peter Laveau that the people making policy for Western financial institutions have it all wrong.
Frankly, I don't think there's any economic problem at the moment, daunting though they may be, that cannot be solved by the abandonment of the austerity program and a general reflation of the European economies, which leads to growth in countries, because growth is one of the ways you deal with debt. At least the Keynesians, you know, have an argument about how to deal with debt. You grow your economy and you pay off the debt. The problem with the austerity people, who are in the lead everywhere at the moment, is they say you've got to shrink your economy to pay off debt, and that is ludicrous. I think what they're worried about in Brussels and the German leadership is the fact that if they do give what they think is a soft ride to Greece, then of course Italy and Spain follow. The only problem with that argument, and it's a serious problem, is that it might be a good thing if they wrote down the debt. And it might be a good thing too if they write down parts of the debt of Italy and Spain as well. We have far too much debt in the world. The austerity policies which are being forced on the government of Greece and all over southern Europe, and indeed on Britain, are not helping our economic situation at all. They're increasing the debt. So I think at some point we're going to have to get to write-downs or haircuts or whatever you want to call it of this debt. And by the way, if we do have to do that, I don't think it'll affect the euro as such. The euro is a totally different operation. It's about the political unity of Europe, which is a far deeper and more important reason for keeping Greece in the club. So here's the issue. I think the European leadership have got this wrong. Basically, austerity policies in countries like Greece and Italy and Spain is only leading to more debt and more trouble. That's why the fundamental thing that unlocks all this, the key that unlocks the problem, is not to abandon the euro, it is to abandon the policy of austerity, which for reasons I can't understand, is being forced on Greece. And just one more quick point. Why on earth is the IMF interfering in Greece and saying, we don't mind your overall numbers here, but we want you to do less on taxes and more on cutting expenditure? That's nothing to do with them. If the Greeks want to solve their problem and get a budget surplus by increasing taxes on the rich, they should be able to do it. The IMF shouldn't interfere on those kind of issues.
While Europe's leading institutions struggle with the first of what will likely be many negotiations to avert a default, Spain, Italy, Portugal, and others are in similarly tough circumstances. In Asia, the founders of the new Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank are getting ready to set up their new institution in Beijing Monday. CCTV's Edwin Marr reports from Beijing.
The prospective founding members of the China-led Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank are set to sign the bank's Articles of Agreement on June 29th. The document sets the bank's rules and bylaws. Earlier, a Chinese foreign ministry spokesperson said President Xi Jinping will meet with the heads of the delegation in Beijing on Monday. The AIIB is expected to be officially established at the end of 2015. The bank, which has 57 prospective founding members, including the UK and Australia, will be based in Beijing. It aims to narrow down Asia's infrastructure gaps by providing financing for infrastructure projects in the region.
The relationship between the EU's institutions and its members, as exhibited over the past months in the treatment of Greece by the EU, ECB, and IMF, stands in stark contrast to the relationships that exist in Latin America and the Caribbean. For more on that, we spoke with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, via Skype from Managua, Friday.
One of the things that we might talk about that would be of great interest to people is the way that Latin American integration is taking on its own momentum in a way that's very different to the integration experience of the European Union, for example.
Yeah, for sure.
And yep. And in Latin America, as we've discussed many times in this program, there's quite a range of political movements that are in government across Latin America and the Caribbean. So, and it's quite interesting to see the way the region's integration momentum has kind of overcome those very obvious political differences. For example, you know, the obvious cases are, for example, the ideological difference between somebody like Juan Manuel Santos, the right-wing president of Colombia, and President Nicolas Maduro of the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela, and completely the other end of the political spectrum.
Right.
But despite those ideological differences, they have managed to forge these integration promoting entities like the Community of Latin American and Caribbean States, like the Union of South American Nations. That's quite fascinating in terms of, you know, how is it possible for Latin America and the Caribbean to overcome those regional differences in a way that genuinely does seem to be benefiting the overall majority?
The structures are not autocratic, that's why, and the power is not centralized. That's the complete opposite of Europe, where you have an elected government trying to restructure its debt with the unions, the various European entities, and they're getting diktat, and they're being called fringe and all this stuff because they're following the program that they ran on and got elected on. Instead, in Latin America, it's like the Chinese said, let 100 flowers bloom, you know, or 1 million flowers bloom. You can have whatever economic system you want. No one's going to dictate to it. Pay your bills, you know, honor your contracts. If they're not working, let's sit down and renegotiate it so it works for everybody. Win-win.
Yeah, and another fundamental component that is likely to promote a more successful pattern of integration in Latin America than the what has resulted in the European Union, is that everybody's treated as equals.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, you know what's to tell for me? Europe is a rich continent with the plunder from the entire world, and the people are looking at declining living standards and absolute poverty on the one hand, and on the other hand, you have many poor and middling countries in the Central America, South America, Caribbean region, and they're all growing, and their people are better off than they were 5 years ago.
Yeah, and I don't think there's any question about that. And the recent signs of the way the integration process is going have been, for example, meetings between President Evo Morales, who's also a very radical, or certainly in Latin American terms, radical and progressive leader, with his center-right counterpart, Ollanta Humala, in Peru. And that's, you know, and what they're talking about is energy integration, infrastructure integration. And the other signs are, for example, Evo Morales again will be visiting Paraguay shortly, again to talk about energy integration. And just over the last couple of days, the president of Paraguay, a right-wing politician, Horacio Cartes, has been meeting with a kind of center-left, his center-left counterpart in Uruguay, Tabaré Vázquez. And there again, what they're talking about is energy integration, infrastructure integration, and also in the case of Cartes and Vázquez, they've been talking about their anxiety to expedite an association of agreement with the European Union between Mercosur. That's a block of countries that includes Paraguay and Uruguay, as well as the two biggest economies in Latin America, Brazil and Argentina. And so that, and that there's all kinds of discussion going on inside Mercosur, which also includes Venezuela. I'm not sure if Bolivia has actually integrated fully as a member of Mercosur, but Bolivia is also a member of Mercosur. And so there's a kind of ongoing argument stroke discussion about, you know, exactly how Mercosur is going to manage its negotiations for an association of agreement with the European Union. And I think that in itself reflects the kind of the differences in the way countries in Latin America tend to, and one doesn't want to idealize it, but there's definitely a tendency in Latin America and the Caribbean for countries to discuss their differences as equals. And that's in marked contrast to what's been going on in the European Union ever since it first started, because in the European Union, France and Germany have always been the one that have called the shots. And so, you know, as you pointed out, the current situation in the European Union with regard to the negotiations for economic assistance to Greece to overcome its economic problems, and really do show up how the way that I remember this quote from the French philosopher Simone Weil, and she wrote in one of her essays prior to the Second World War, even before the opening up of the concentration camps, she wrote that what the Nazis of Nazi Germany were doing to the populations, their subject populations in Europe, was the reason that people in Europe were so upset and aghast at it was because they saw Nazi Germany applying to white people in Europe what the European colonial powers had been applying to the majority world population for five centuries.
Right, that's true.
And so, you know, and now what's happening is that you can see it again. I mean, the reasons a lot of people are so shocked by what's happening to Greece is because what the European Union is doing to the people of Greece is a structural adjustment program that prior to the recent crisis derived from the collapse of 2008, those structural adjustment programs were only applied to
the South, that's right.
The people in the majority world. And,
that's right.
And so, you know, and it's a very important lesson for people in Europe, I think, and one that people in Latin America are observing with much interest.
It's very similar to the experience that whites, quote unquote, are getting in the United States now. They're learning in some ways. They still got a lot of skin privilege, particularly when the police are aiming a gun. But they're learning that they too can be forced to accept the fact that their condition is not going to improve, and that their children's condition is not going to improve, and that their housing situation is going to be unstable, and that their employment situation is going to be unstable, and they have to like it or lump it. And that was the treatment that was given to black folks and brown folks and red folks and yellow folks for centuries in this country.
Right. And I read an interesting article. I've forgotten what website it was. I think it might have been Zero Hedge. But they were talking about the way huge numbers of people in the U.S. are no longer able to afford their own house, and so they're forced into the rental market, and right. The way the rental market is gobbling up anything between 30 and or more than 50% of those people's income.
Right. That's right.
And so that's, you know, that, and you obviously are going to know a lot more about that than me, but I mean, the relevance of that for, you know, people in Latin America is that they look at all these processes that are taking place in the United States and in Europe, and they realize that all the kind of flim-flam, hogwash, neoliberal economics, you know, and they have failed. They've completely failed. And I think that's one of the reasons why right-wing governments here in Latin America are more ready to engage in a positive way with people who have a different agenda. The fact that CEPAL, for example, which is the United Nations Economic Commission for Latin America and the Caribbean, and I think the acronym in English is ECLAC, but they're a United Nations body that provide analysis and comment and recommendations and policy consultations for the region, and they recognize, for example, that among the countries likely to enjoy the highest growth in Latin America over the next 2 to 3 years, figure Bolivia and Nicaragua.
Right.
Which are two countries of the ALBA bloc. And Peru's there as well. And so there's a recognition that no single model and no single ideology has all the answers to the very diverse economic problems that confront the populations of Latin America and the Caribbean.
You know, not only that, when you come to the dance, you come with the clothes that you're wearing, you know, and the history has brought, you know, the political systems, the social and cultural and institutional structures of all these different countries to where they are now. And that's where they have to work from. But the one unifying ideology, if you want to call it that, is the approach that Chavez counseled and built into structures that is allowing this type of integration. And if you think about all those structures over just geography and economic activity, and then the forms of economic activity that are applied in different places, it's the same thing that Lenin did, where here we would have capitalist market-type forces working. Here we would have, you know, try to build state structures, because those were the things that were appropriate to each of the sets of conditions that he was faced with. It's reality. That's what it is. Yeah. It's an acknowledgement of reality.
Yeah, and perhaps realism is the thing that characterizes the integration process more than anything here in Latin America. And they're not allowing themselves, the leaders in the region are not allowing themselves to be intimidated and intellectually enslaved or emotionally enslaved, if you like, by a particular vision, which is what has happened in Europe. Mm-hmm. And where the elites in Europe have completely ignored and shoved to the margins. Legitimate criticism of the European vision and what it might mean in terms of democracy, popular participation, and all that stuff. And that isn't happening in Latin America. And that's very important for the peaceful and successful development of economic integration in the region.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.